I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're delighted to have Clarence Page with us this hour. Clarence has been on our show many times before and was kind enough to come to the NPR studios a few years ago, and we did our live broadcast from NPR. He has compiled a book that is selected columns, and he made the selections of 1984 to 2014 that Clarence wrote. And it coincides with the 30th anniversary of his first Chicago Tribune column. The book is Culture Warrior, Reflections on Race, Politics, and Social Change. Clarence joined the Trib in 69. He became a columnist 15 years later. In 1989, awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Commentary. The column was first syndicated nationally in 1987 and is featured now in more than 150 publications. And he's on radio and TV nationally as well, a frequent guest on NPR's Weekend Edition and MSNBC's The Chris Matthews Show. He also would probably, and I hope some of you have this happening in your kitchens right now, maybe even more important than the Pulitzer is the refrigerator Pulitzer. And he loves it when someone says they like a column so much they pinned it to the door of the refrigerator. Hello, Clarence.
Hello, Kathleen. Hi. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Just great.
I'm glad to hear that. 30 years of columns, sir. Boy, this was an interesting history lesson for me as well as for you to look back at what you've lived through and what we've all lived through, huh?
That's right. Time flies, first of all.
I know, doesn't it? I know it does.
It's like only yesterday, yeah.
Yeah, it goes...
Yeah, but I've been, well, you know, it's interesting. When I knew my 30th anniversary was coming up, I decided to grit my teeth and go back and read my old columns, which something columnists hate to do, I have found. But it was enlightening, you know. I mean, I really covered a period from the early 80s, the rise of AIDS and crack wars and Reagan and Madonna to the age of Ebola and medical marijuana and Barack Obama and Lady Gaga.
Yeah, exactly. You've covered a lot, sir. You know, I was struck by the column that you wrote, and you start the book with this because we have the anniversary of September 11th on Thursday. We have the president meeting with advisors, talking about terrorism again, and a major announcement tomorrow.
Right.
And it was a while ago, except that you personalize your column sometimes, too. I was so struck. We have a son who's the same age, and your 12-year-old son's school called. It was the day of the attacks on September 11th, and he knew that your office was near the White House, and he called because he was worried about you. You must have reread that and thought about how he has grown and thought about how that defined, in many ways, his generation.
Yeah, he's out of college now, you know, and it's like that's the millennial generation.
Mm-hmm.
I think 9/11 for so many of them is like JFK's assassination for my generation, mm-hmm. back in the early 60s, a defining moment. And I also remember at that time, my son, you know, as the war buildup came along, he was asking if he was going to get drafted.
Mm.
And I said, oh, son, by the time you're 18, I'm sure we'll be out of there.
I know.
You know, it's you never know what's going to happen in a war once you get in. But certainly right now, we are in many ways still wrestling with these same issues internationally and domestically that we were trying to handle back then.
Yeah, it's interesting what you write, because here we are again, and you say this will test our ability to rally behind an effective counter-terrorist war, which evidently we still don't know how to lead, because here we are these many years later, and also our ability to avoid turning against each other while we wage it. Very prescient comments for that day so many years ago, and they're still important words.
Well, that's what really worries me now, really, is our ability to stand together. Colleague of mine was saying, and this was a few years ago at the height of the real before the first government shutdown, and was saying, you know, you remember that back at 9/11 when both houses of Congress, Republican and Democrat, all came together for a big group photo to mm-hmm. show solidarity, and they sang God Bless America spontaneously together. And he said, You know, today I'm worried that if the same kind of thing happened, that instead of standing together, a large portion of Congress would be calling for the president's impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a troubling thing to me because I remember how well people stood together behind President Bush. And I myself, I had a lot of criticisms of Bush politically, but I said a little prayer saying I sure wish him the best because, you know, he's the only president we got. And to his credit, he really stood up there in those early days with his speeches and all, hit just the right notes that pulled us together. I think the country was remarkably unified for at least 4 or 5 days.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I guess the country also then never thought, as your son never thought and you never thought, that we would be fighting the same kind of battle all these years later.
That's right. Although, you know, we kind of had an inkling of it when the war against terror or war against terrorism was declared. I mean, how do you declare a war against the tactic? We've had terrorism going on throughout recorded history, and it's going to continue one way or another. What I think we have yet to grapple with is getting a handle on what is really happening among the Islamic extremists and their interplay with various governments. You know, what I see happening now with the rise of the Islamic State reminds me of when we pulled out of Afghanistan right after the Soviet Union collapsed. Remember, and left the Mujahideen that we were allied with, just left them high and dry, and they evolved into al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
Because we just thought, well, that's over. We'll just pack up and leave like we did in Vietnam and let people worry about it themselves. Well, it's not that easy in that part of the world, and especially when you're dealing with religious extremists.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to you and your life. Southern Ohio, you write early in the book where you grew up and you learned journalism, taught you about life in the heartland. Chicago taught you that African-Americans are just one of many ethnic tribes in our American quilt, and Chicago taught you about diversity in both places you go on, because this is quite a skill to be able to be comfortable with so many different people, with Thurgood Marshall, with Sarah Palin, with Ralph Nader, with Pat Robertson or the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, that you feel comfortable with a broad audience. A lot of people don't.
Well, thank you. You know, I think that's one theme that emerged as I was reading back over the years, how some people are comfortable with diversity while others are not.
Right.
I even have a chapter in the book titled Diversity Anxiety because I'm really struck by, my friend Pat Buchanan, for example, who I've been a colleague on McLaughlin Group since the late 80s. And people are amazed when I tell them, but Pat's a really nice guy to know as long as you don't discuss politics.
He is. Yeah, I interviewed him once. He is a really nice guy. No.
Very much so.
Yeah.
You find that a lot in Washington. And but you're not going to find that out if you're not curious about other people enough to give them a chance to show you who they really are. And I used to say back, I told Pat back in when he ran for president back in the 90s that, you know, I love you, Pat, but you don't really know your friends until they run for president because, you know, his the xenophobia. Remember the Buchanan fence. He wanted to build a big fence or a wall along the Mexican border. That was an extreme idea back then, and now it's no longer extreme. It's mainstream.
Yeah.
And we're still debating whether to complete the fence that's already been built.
Mm-hmm.
But there's when you talk about getting along with other people, you know, my friend Kojo Namdi, who's got a public radio show here in Washington, was asked by some kids, how do you become a journalist? And he said, learn how to write and have an unending curiosity.
Absolutely.
And I love that line. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really true. I'm going to use it myself. With
right.
or without credit, because it's really true. I think, me and my colleagues that I've come up with since our student days, we've all had that kind of curiosity about other people.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have that, you're going to, you know, maybe you ought to be in another business.
Yeah. And you've also been alive at a really interesting time, haven't you?
Yeah,
really interesting. You were born in a poor family, you say, and you were seeing the end of Jim Crow and all that's happened with, although the issues of race are still very much with us, but what's happened in terms of war and race and the women's movement and assassinations and What a time to be, a lot of people say that, but it is quite a time to live.
Well, especially for us boomers, because right. we believe our generation and our time is the best ever, you know.
Right.
And it's funny how things, what comes around goes around. I grew up in Middletown, Ohio, between Cincinnati and Dayton, which is also the home area of John Boehner. That's his district. And he's also only about a year older or younger than me. I forget which now, but we were talking once, you know, just kind of comparing how we grew up, because he grew up in a working class family, as did I. The only difference was when he got his first paycheck and he saw how high the taxes were, he decided he was a Republican. whereas when I was in high school and I liked Barry Goldwater, but when he voted against the 64 Civil Rights Act, I was alienated from Republicans at that point. And it's like, you know, these are the kind of things that can have a big impact on you as you grow up.
Absolutely.
Different experiences.
Absolutely. So tell me about, this is somebody I would love to have interviewed had we been alive and I'd been working at the same time. But you you had a chance to ask Thurgood Marshall, how do you want to be remembered at his final press conference? It's one of the columns. I love that column.
Oh, I never forget that moment either, because I have to say in preface, I just moved to Washington. I hardly had my bags unpacked when I got a notice that Thurgood Marshall was going to give a news conference over at the Supreme Court. He'd been rumored to be considering retiring. And, you know, that I just immediately jumped in a taxi, rushed over there and wanted to be there. And I had to be the oldest reporter in the room, I think. But it was a really stirring moment for me. And these young reporters were asking him, they all had one question, basically. What do you think of Clarence Thomas?
Right.
Because that at the time, he was the reported choice to possibly replace Marshall. And Marshall just said, an old man said that there ain't no difference between a white snake or a black snake. They both bite. And that's all he said to answer that question.
That was like, quite an answer.
Like the Delphic Oracle, you know?
Yeah, right.
You just had to figure it out yourself, right? And he... And so they kind of played this kind of merry-go-round, and they all tried to pin him down on Clarence Thomas. And finally, they were starting to run out of questions. I just said, Mr. Justice, how do you want to be remembered? And he looked up at me and squinted up at me, and he said without pause, he did the best he could with what he had. And that became the headline in Time magazine the next week across two pages. It really says so much about him, because he did achieve so much. You know, I mean, I remember Jim Crow, but barely. He was in the thick of it. And heaven knows, barely escaped lynching sometimes when he was down south trying to save other people from being lynched. And was, as you know, led the argument for that became the Brown versus Board of Education decision.
Yes,
and,
sir.
Then became the first African American on the Supreme Court, et cetera, et cetera. A man of amazing achievements, but yet was so humble in the end, the best he could with what he had, because he started out humble too. So
yeah.
It's something I pass on to young people now.
Yeah. I hadn't realized until you reminded me that he had argued 32 cases before the Supreme Court, and he won 29 of them?
The man was a genius. It was remarkable.
I guess.
At the same time, you know, he had to go to the Howard University Law School in Washington because the University of Maryland wouldn't take African-American students. And so they subsidized his tuition to drive all the way to D.C. and back. He commuted back and forth from Baltimore to Washington to go to law school.
Yeah. Well, as long as you brought up Clarence Thomas, you wrote a very interesting piece about Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas, and for many in our audience, well, not that many, but some, they won't even remember what that was. But
yes.
it was a good column because I remember those hearings so vividly, and you said that until we speak more candidly with one another and come to grips with the glaring but seldom acknowledged class and gender differences and resentments within our own community, we'll continue to be vulnerable to manipulation by politicians. Let's talk more about that and what you made of those hearings and what you make of Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court and Anita Hill's testimony. It was really quite a, boy, that was riveting.
Well, it was. And what's striking about the passage you read is it reminds me of how divisive the Thomas Hill hearings were among African Americans.
Right.
We all try to, Zora Neale Hurston once said, everybody wants to simplify the Negro. It's still true. Everybody wants to oversimplify race. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated issue. And even among African Americans, we like to think we have the inside track on racial understanding because of our condition. We had to be more racially aware all of our lives here. But when the Thomas Hill hearings came along, it really divided African Americans. I remember PBS Frontline did a documentary on it eventually, you had this the sense in the past, that, well, if they're black, you got to support them. Mm-hmm. But with Clarence Thomas, he had been opposed to affirmative action, very critical of it in many ways, even though he was former Equal Employment Opportunity Director. And he was sponsored by conservative Republicans. So there was a real question about trust. And Thomas, I think a pivotal moment was during the hearings when all the controversy was brewing around. And Thomas said very forthrightly that he was the victim of a high-tech lynching. That was a pivotal moment because African Americans could have said, what's he doing exploiting lynching? On the other hand, it struck a chord with a lot of people that mm-hmm. they saw this black man facing this all-white panel of senators. And including Strom Thurmond up there, who was on Clarence Thomas' side. I mean, things really get complicated, right?
Yes.
There was that angle, and there was also the unresolved issues around women mm-hmm. in the African-American community. That's what really came out around Anita Hill. She was called Jezebel and all kinds of other derogatory terms by a lot of people, saying, why are you trying to get that brother in trouble and blah, blah, blah. And on the other hand, it was how can you ignore what Anita Hill has gone through? And,
right.
and look at her. She's facing that same all-white panel up there, too. So, yeah, it really struck a lot of nerves in the African-American community in particular. Everybody who was around at the time remembers it. But I think it was one of the most racially divisive episodes to come along until the O.J. Simpson verdict a few years later.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's go into O.J., where it was amazing because I was watching all of that with African-American staff member and I were watching it, and we had completely really different viewpoints of what was going on. But you write about 2/3 of African-Americans believe that O.J. was innocent and 2/3 of white Americans. And I couldn't believe that. I thought, mm-hmm. we're all going to agree here. It was one of those instances, Clarence, where I was dumbfounded that we had completely different interpretations of what was going on.
That's the O.J. Simpson moment.
Oh, it was.
History, because
yes, it
it's
was.
A moment of awareness. We are so different, it's not just skin color. Growing up in America, you can grow up with a different experience if you're white as opposed to if you're black. And those differences give you differences in points of view that may not come out in your day-to-day activities. And I'll never forget when I was with a group of fellow journalists, mostly white, when the verdict came in, and we stopped everything to watch that program. And I remember just before that verdict was announced, it flashed through my mind, oh, my God, I wonder how, because they were showing these white and black crowds in different camera angles. And I said, oh, my God, how is this reaction going to come down? I kind of had an inkling it was going to be stark, and I didn't realize it was going to be that stark, because
right.
it was really like, one a shot of white people crying and another shot of black people cheering, jumping out of their
I
feet.
Know, really.
And, the problem after that is how do you interpret that? I think a lot of people I know talking to from the black experience said, there was a moment of exuberance over the fact that a black man can now be wealthy enough to get white man's justice.
Mm-hmm.
If you follow that, that's the difference, with the past. But I think a lot of other people looked at it and they saw a reverse of the To Kill a Mockingbird scenario, where a black man railroaded in front of an all-white jury. In other words, racial payback.
Yeah.
And you still hear that same kind of divide being expressed by people today around issues like Ferguson and
absolutely,
other
absolutely. Well, the thing about Ferguson here is it is these many years later, and you hear story after story after story of African-Americans in Ferguson who've had these horrendous and repeated encounters with police. It's like everybody.
Right, right. That's right. And, even I was noticing certain things I took for granted, like somebody mentioned, it's been mentioned a lot now, whether Ferguson was a sundown town. You know what that is?
Yes, I do.
You may have had the author. There was a book about sundown towns written a few years ago. It might have been on your show. Sundown towns were towns where a black person had better be out before sundown. And there were a lot of towns like that across America. And I remember when I was a kid traveling with my parents, because my family is originally from Alabama, going down to visit relatives and all, we would sleep in the car because there wasn't any place for black folks couldn't just pull off the road and sleep at a Holiday Inn or whatever like
right.
today.
Yeah.
And you also knew, you know, going through certain towns, it was like, is this a sundown town or not? You know, we better not hang around here too long. You know, just keep on driving and blah, blah, blah. Those are things that African-Americans of my generation just take for granted, so that we just forgot about them until something like Ferguson comes along, and then you remember and you wonder, what kind of town is that Ferguson?
Right, yeah. Well, we want to talk about Al Sharpton. I know you've written about him. There are several earlier columns about Al Sharpton, and one recently, why was he the voice that was sent to Ferguson? Some interesting things about his past as well. So we'll talk with Clarence Page about that. Clarence Page is our guest this hour, and he's just in celebration of 30 years of columns for the Chicago Tribune. It's syndicated now in many newspapers. Selected columns 1984 to 2014. The book is Culture Warrior, Reflections on Race, Politics, and Social Change. And it really is, because he's been interpreting history of the time. So when you've been writing columns for that long a period, it's a historical lesson for us, sometimes written under deadline, but beautifully written under deadline, as many of the columns have been. And lots of columns on all kinds of things, on particularly race, politics, and social change. We're welcoming phone calls for Clarence, too. I don't mean to just keep talking to him. So let me invite you. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Clarence Page is with us this hour. His book is Culture Warrior, Reflections on Race, Politics, and Social Change. It's a collection, and he selected the columns of 172 columns from 1984 to 2014. A lot of calls coming in. We'll start with Wayne in Holman. Hello, Wayne.
Hey, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome, sir.
It was nice of you. You're always polite to me, even though I'm a conservative Republican. Clarence, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
You too, Wayne. Thanks for calling.
I mentioned to your screener, who was a very nice young man. I watched a program this morning on CBS, and I typically watch that. And it showed George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, and I wanted to ask Clarence his thoughts on this. These two guys look like they're really buddies, and I don't like it. They
yeah,
each had their arm on each other at times, and we're reminiscing about Bill Clinton said that George W. Bush would call him and he would call George W. Bush, and they'd talk for like almost an hour.
Right,
and,
that's right.
And I thought that is really cool that guys like would do that. And I also remember that Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill got along fabulously after hours.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right.
Would tip a brew or whatever, and I really was impressed when I saw these two. And then they went to Barbara Bush, and she said, the Bush family loves Bill Clinton. We just don't love his politics.
Right.
And I thought that was really good. And, I love WPR, and I don't listen to MSNBC because I've heard too many hateful things on that network. But I think I agree with you that there has to be room for more common understanding and finding common ground. And I don't see it today from the left or the right. Kind of sad, and I'm sure as a writer and a very skilled one at that, you sometimes become chagrined at the gridlock that's happening. But I think it comes from both sides, Clarence. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, thank you. I agree, and it is something that hits me with chagrin. As recently as the 1990s, you had Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich working together, even while they were fighting. The result was welfare reform and a balanced budget. This is how legislation is supposed to work in Washington, and we've gotten so much more polarized since then that it's just just not possible at the moment, it seems. And I really miss that. You know, I mentioned a few moments ago, Pat Buchanan and I have worked together for years. And it amazes me. I marvel at this. When I first got to Washington, when I first moved here in 91, I learned that Orrin Hatch and Senator Ted Kennedy played tennis together after work. And I mean, Orrin Hatch campaigned against Ted Kennedy by name out in Utah when he ran for the Senate. But after he got here, he learned that they could work together. And, you know, more recently you had John McCain and Ted Kennedy working together on, George W. Bush, as well as John McCain, working together with Ted Kennedy on education reform.
Right.
And so we're in a bad period right now, and I think part of it is, you mentioned that, you know, Fox and MSNBC, the media environment now is different than it used to be, and that plays a role. You didn't have TV channels that were 24/7. Campaigning against the president every day and not even letting facts get in the way of a good story sometimes. And that doesn't help matters. But I am not one to blame the media for everything since I'm part of the media.
You're a big part of the media, Clarence. Thank
not
you.
Big enough. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Wayne, very much for the call. So let's talk about Al Sharpton for a moment, because I found it interesting as I was reading your book that there are a lot of other columns about Al Sharpton, and they're not all complimentary. It's sort of, you know, presenting an honest view of him. I had no idea that he was James Brown's front man. I didn't know that. So sort of got his style.
He's led a remarkable life.
He really has.
He made his public debut at the New York World's Fair back in 65, 66, when he was about 12 years old, something like that, as a preacher. And he later worked for James Brown, and Brown took him under wing and adopted him, and he became Brown's road manager. I mean, it's a remarkable story. And you're right. My early columns especially were not complimentary of Sharpton, and he does not forget that, even as he invites me on his TV show.
Oh, really? He didn't forget that. Oh, that's interesting.
No, but I tell you, I've covered Al Sharpton since those days. I've covered Jesse Jackson even longer.
Right.
And me and other reporters who've covered Sharpton, whatever we think of his politics, he's a fun guy to cover in a lot of ways because he doesn't take things personally. He really does have a showman's approach to politics and public action, and is very candid about his ambition, his hungry ambition for prominence on the civil rights scene and all. But one thing I have to point out, though, in Ferguson as well as these other places where Al Sharpton goes in, he goes in after he's invited. It was the family of Michael Brown, the shooting victim out there, that invited Al Sharpton in because they knew he was going to get some attention and he would amplify the voice of the family. Same thing with Trayvon Martin's family down in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that, and I saw the same thing happen for 40 some odd years with Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson never gone to one of these places where he wasn't invited by some local people because they know he amplifies their voice. And so I was interested to see what would happen if we had a black man in the White House. And you notice for the last few years, you haven't heard that much from Sharpton or Jackson, but it bodes poorly, in my view, for where race is today, that we see Sharpton and Jackson becoming prominent once again in the wake of racial tragedies.
Yeah, so what is that all about? And you'll, being in Washington and being an insider here, we have read that Sharpton, you know, gets his phone calls answered when he calls the White House, and he goes over and talks, and obviously the White House knew that he was going to be a major voice in Ferguson, and the president sent Holder, but perhaps the president should have gone. Why all of a sudden embracing Sharpton? What is that strategy?
Yeah, I called Sharpton President Obama's passion surrogate. It's like, you know, the one complaint that Obama gets from a number of people in the black community, as well as other liberals, Maureen Dowd and others, is that he's not passionate enough, that he doesn't seem to be engaged enough. He's too aloof. And they love the poetry of his speeches, but that's not enough. They want to see him get mad or whatever. And but you saw what happened when, like, after Trayvon Martin, when he gave a simple a line about how if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon. Well, Newt Gingrich jumped on top of him saying that's racist, and other people, you know, from the right made the same complaint. So Obama is not a confrontationist. He doesn't want to stir things up in a negative way. And I'm not saying that he asked Sharpton to go out there because he didn't, but Sharpton does. At that funeral, a lot of people, some of Sharpton's biggest critics, said that he really stepped up at that funeral and chose the right words, not only condemning the tragedy, but also urging the black community to get together and work on internal problems like black-on-black crime, et cetera, which takes a much bigger toll than white-on-black homicide. And it's an interesting period we're in now where the Obama administration, the White House team, Obama himself, has worked with Sharpton in an interesting way since the presidential campaign of 08, when Sharpton was one who was, well, between he and Hillary Clinton, they were both trying to get Sharpton's endorsement and support. And Sharpton eventually swung with Obama, and it became important later on when Cornel West and Tavis Smiley, among other black critics of Obama, stepped up and said he wasn't doing enough for the black community.
Yes.
Sharpton has been one of Obama's strongest advocates in the black community, saying, you know, he's doing this and he would do more, but he's got to fight those Republicans, so you got to help out with your support, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how he gets his phone calls returned over at the White House. Whereas there is some memory in the White House of back when Jesse Jackson said he wanted to cut off part of Obama's anatomy.
Oh, yeah. You wrote about that in one of the columns.
Uh-huh. Yes, indeed. Yeah, because that was interesting because after that episode happened, I first heard about it from Jesse Jackson, who called my office.
He did?
Right away,
really?
As well as other media people. Yeah, because he knew as soon as that video leaked out that he was going to get blowback. So he called various media people to prepare us for it, to let us know that this was coming and this is what he really meant, blah, blah, blah. And it was, but, you know, as I wrote, he actually helped Obama at the time. It became Obama's sister soldier moment.
Yes.
It helped him with a lot of white voters who were skeptical of Obama's sincerity or whether or not he was going to be in the hip pocket of Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton. This certainly showed that he was not. So it's one of those ironies of modern politics.
Yeah. Let's go to Marshall in Minneapolis. Hello, Marshall.
Hi, good afternoon. And first of all, Clarence, I want to let you know I was a Tribune newspaper delivery boy back in the late 70s and early 80s.
Oh, my man, that's how I got started in the business at age 12.
There you go. So it's real easy for people these days to talk about the big disasters of race and culture in our country, whether it be St. Louis or the Trayvon situation, et cetera. And then people seem to kind of dogpile onto the whole situation, if you will. But how would you, in terms of, so it's easier to talk about the negative things that are happening, but how would you grade, as a unbiased journalist, how would you grade the leaders of the black community as they talk more about the future and personal responsibility and that sort of thing? I know Bill Cosby has taken a different approach than a lot of the other black leaders that you've talked about. What are your thoughts about how you would grade people, say, in the last 5 to 10 years, of bringing people together as opposed to dividing them?
Good question, and worth a book in itself. I have several columns on Bill Cosby because I first interviewed him back when I was in college at Ohio University when he came to perform, and I interviewed him for the student paper. And at the time, in fact, he was he disappointed me. This was like in 69, and a lot of performers came to the campus and were talking about the war and civil rights and black power. And Cosby didn't really want to talk about that. He wanted to talk about how, you know, you kids have got a great opportunity here at the university. Take advantage of it. All he wanted to talk about was he just wanted to stress education and help yourself. The doors of opportunity are opening up and all this. And at the time, I was thinking, boy, he's really square. He sounds like my grandparents, you know. And he did sound like my grandparents. But now that I am a parent,
absolutely,
I give the same sermon to my kid, you know.
Right.
And what I love about Cosby is, in a nonpartisan way, he has shown that there's a strong conservative streak in the black community. And it is not being expressed, unfortunately enough, by our conservative politicians. Jack Kemp was a wonderful exception, and he has unfortunately passed away now. And nobody's really quite picked it up. However, just last night, coincidentally, I was at a forum with your Wisconsin representative there, Paul Ryan.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, and it was held by Bob Woodson, the kind of black leader who doesn't make a lot of headlines because he is a conservative who works with grassroots organizations across the country. I've known him for over 20 years, and he is someone who he's a doer more than a talker, although he gives terrific speeches. But he has worked with grassroots networks of organizations all around the country in some really low-income neighborhoods, high-crime areas with violence prevention programs, a variety of programs that really work. And he was an associate of Jack Kemp, just like at the same time Paul Ryan was a protege of Kemp's. And, you know, this is a streak of conservatism I've been trying to boost in my column. And I've got several chapters in my book about Woodson and his organizations and the good they've done. As Bob always said, I don't care who's right or who's left. I care about what works. And these pragmatic programs are the sort that I hope Ryan can, if he runs for president, will help to give voice to that. He tried in 2012, but the Romney campaign wasn't interested in that kind of urban issue. In retrospect, Romney wishes he had been. The same thing back in 96 when Jack Kemp was a running mate of Bob Dole. The Dole campaign didn't see any percentage in pushing for inner city votes or urban support in that way. So this is my way of answering the question about black leadership. Don't just go by the black leaders you see on page one of the newspaper. Go back to the neighborhood news section. See what black leaders you see back there. When I wrote about Ferguson the first time, I said, there's all this attention that the world is giving to Ferguson, but the answer has got to come from local Ferguson community leaders. It's got to come from those grassroots. And we're starting to see that happen in Ferguson, but you got to go to Ferguson to see it because these networks just don't cover those local people.
Right. Thank you so much, Marshall, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Clarence Page is our guest this hour, and a collection of his wonderful columns from a 30-year period of time, 1984 to 2014, is in his just-published book, Culture Worrier, Reflections on Race, Politics, and Social Change. We have a couple lines open if you want to join us, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Clarence Page, our guest this hour. The book is Culture Worrier. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We were both alive, young at the time, but both alive during the 1960s, Clarence, when so many assassinations took place. Dr. Martin Luther King, I was interested in the column that you wrote 20 years after his assassination, what people have done to his memory. And I'm wondering how you might up that, what you wrote then, and how you might update that column now.
Well, I think today, there's a lot of ways I could update it, among them how we've got lots and lots of streets named after Martin Luther King.
Yes, we do.
Nine times out of ten, they're in the worst part of town.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of poignant imagery one can draw from that. But the other thing, which really hasn't changed since I was writing about him years ago, is how most people want to remember him for like one line in the "I Have a Dream" speech, about a man. I have a dream that someday a man will be judged by the not by the color of his skin, but the content of his character. There's a lot more to that speech, and I commend everyone to go and look it up on the internet. Everything's on the internet. Google it up and see the rest of it, because it is a speech that lays out an agenda for reparations and one for healing and for action. That was one that was just kind of, I guess, didn't grab a lot of attention at the time because the public sentiment was so much in favor of public action to make up for the sins of the past. Nowadays, when you read it, he sounds like what they call a militant radical today. But it was. But this is how I think King gets remembered in sort of. I think in that column you mentioned, I referred to the sanitized King, because that's what folks these days tend to remember the most.
Yeah. We have to remember our history, right? We did a show on history last hour. We just sanitize it somehow, or we don't want to read it in all its complexity and the things that might make us uncomfortable. And he's definitely worth reading and feeling uncomfortable if you don't quite like some of what he says.
He's... Yeah, and I noticed this. Talk about history. When my son was in grade school, one day I asked him about something about, you know, did you know Lincoln grew up in a log cabin? Have you heard that story in history? He said, they don't teach us much history, Dad. And then I learned that grade schools are, and high schools are teaching a lot less history than they used to, partly because of the backlash against liberal arts when everybody's so careerist, but also because it's so controversial. The principals don't want to deal with parents coming to school and say, what are you teaching my kid here about the Civil War or whatever? And that's too bad. I have, living in Washington especially, has given me a new appreciation for history. And I got down here, I learned the Civil War never ended. It was just intermission, as the old thing goes. And I live right near Fort Stevens, where the only battle site where Lincoln was fired upon. And I turned the corner. I'm only a couple of blocks from my house. Used to be owned by Frederick Douglass's daughter. And, I feel like history really lives around here. And I want to do a history book just to deal with some of the misconceptions I've heard.
Good. So do it, Clarence. Excellent idea. Excellent. Let's go next to Greg in Woodruff. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Clarence. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Greg.
I have been reading a book by Glenn Greenwald called No Place to Hide about the NSA and the surveillance disclosures of Edward Snowden. And from what I know about the story and how it's been treated so far, it seems that Snowden himself has become the story. He remains in exile. And all of the astonishing, appalling documents that that he disclosed have been somewhat swept under the rug. And I'm wondering if Clarence thinks that... that's going to be the end of the story, that Snowden will be villainized and that the wildly illegal practices of the NSA and others are simply going to continue as if the story never happened.
Well, a very good question. I think, for one thing, it hasn't been forgotten, certainly not by the rest of the world. Much of the uproar we see in the Middle East, the Arab Spring and the current IS war and all, a lot of it resulted from the disclosures that Snowden made insofar as the relations that the Saudis and others have had with the United States, the secret wars that have been going on. And the whole issue about whether Snowden should be prosecuted and what is prosecutable and what should be secret and what shouldn't is certainly very much alive. I'm on the board of the Committee to Protect Journalists, and I was one of the journalists in one of the meetings that Eric Holder had after after his office had gone after journalists at the AP and Fox News.
Yeah.
And those cases are not fully resolved yet either. I think that the Obama administration is somewhat chastened after being criticized for being more repressive of the press since any president since Richard Nixon. That's not who you want to be compared to.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a but at the same time, though, the secrecy has continued, and even White House reporters complain about administration not being more forthcoming. And this is the side of the Obama administration you don't hear a lot about, but it is definitely there. But, you know, what's interesting to me, Kathleen, is I wonder how much Americans want to know the secrets.
Right.
You know, this is a core of the debate. Glenn Greenwald is a y'all come and here's everything kind of guy to throw open the doors. There are a lot of Americans who think, well, maybe not that wide, you know. But that's the kind of a serious debate that I think makes a lot of people's heads hurt. So they're the ones who want to change the subject and turn to the sports page.
Right. Yeah. I was amazed how a lot of those stories just didn't have much traction. People don't seem to be particularly worried about the extent of U.S. spying, I don't think. I don't quite get it, but they don't seem to be very concerned.
Well, it's interesting. I think, well, a lot of people find it reassuring, actually. That our government spies say, yeah, do some more.
Right.
Because they don't think down the road to where, well, what if it turns against you? I always think about, you know, it's the same thing like with the militarization of the police. Folks didn't care much about that and still until we started to see SWAT teams breaking down the wrong door.
Mm-hmm.
And a nice family suddenly has their evening disrupted by a SWAT team coming in the door and putting them on the floor and flash bombs going off and blah, blah, blah. And now after Ferguson, after people have seen how this plays out in real life, people are having second thoughts about it.
Yeah. Thanks, Greg, for your call. Jeremy in Chicago. Hi. Jeremy?
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Good afternoon. I have a question about race, really how it changed racism between the generations. I'm from Chicago, I live in Chicago. I was at a high school sporting event recently. And at the end of the game, I noticed that the white kids, the Latino kids, and the black or African-American children all left the game very separately. And it was a pretty stark image to me. No one was interacting. They were leaving in separate groups. And I was talking to a young black man afterwards, and I said to him about that, you know, is there a degree of racism still, even among the different groups? And his answer fascinated me. He said, oh, no. We no longer have sort of, there's no racism between us. We are absolutely fine with each other. We just find it far easier to be with people of our own background and our own heritage. And his comment to me was like, we've actually gone beyond the racism. But we're just happy where we are. That really perplexed me and confused me. And I'm just wondering, is there less racism today among the younger generations, or is it still as prevalent? And as you can probably tell by my accent, I'm foreign. And I'm, as an outsider of the United States, I find the situation quite confusing. I'd love to hear your insight on that.
And where are you from, Jeremy? Clarence asked.
I'm originally from London, live in Chicago.
Okay.
Right. Well, London has some very interesting racial situations, too, which I could talk about, but I won't spend your time on that. I think, what you're saying is something I've observed, and I've got a son now in his 20s. I've grown up with this generation as well. And I say, first of all, yes, young people are a lot less racist than their elders for a lot of different reasons, just like my generation is less racist than my elders. And my parents' generation was racist, if you want to call it that, mainly out of the need to be defensive, to be wary of what could happen to them. And what we have now, though, I think we should not confuse racism with tribalism or, as sociologists call it, homophily, which is the natural human tendency to want to be with people like yourself. It's also known as birds of a feather flock together. You know that's that old saying?
Sure.
Well, sociologists are very serious about this because it is the foundation of tribes, first of all. And civilization was the breaking down of those tribal barriers to get people of different tribes to work together. That's what we strive to have in our country. But for people to say, I don't see race, or that, you know, racism is over, or blah, 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 that's denial. That's fooling ourselves. A lot of people just don't want to talk about race because it's an uncomfortable topic. But when we don't talk about it, then we don't really understand. Why do the kids after the basketball game go different directions? Because they live in different neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And this gets back to a history of housing discrimination, et cetera, and housing patterns and all that. I remember once seeing after a football game, the white players got on one bus to go home and the black players got on the other. And I said, what's going on? And I said, well, one bus they play R&B and hip hop. The other bus they play country and western. So guess which race went to which bus? Do I have to tell you? You know, and this has come up now with this controversy. I could go on all day, but the Atlanta Hawks owner who just quit, who just resigned after an email in which he was musing about how they could attract more white customers, more white basketball fans. And one thing he mentioned was that the music during the game was all R&B and hip hop.
Right.
You know, I went to a Washington Nationals game here in Washington last week, and I noticed that my wife and I both noticed that the music they were playing alternated between country and western to hip hop to
right.
country rock
right.
to heavy metal. You know, they had a mix, and it was obvious they did this on purpose. It was really obvious.
Yeah.
So you know, that's why I say, you know, let's not fool ourselves and say race doesn't matter. They'll pay attention to it. Believe me, politicians and marketing executives are very well aware of the difference race and culture make.
Clarence, thank you so much for being with us. I love having you on the show. Thank you.
I love being on your show. Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Thanks, Clarence. Clarence Page, his book is Culture Warrior, Reflections on Race, Politics, and Social Change. It's selected columns. He chose the columns for the past 30 years, so it's a history lesson as well, 1984 to 2014. Clarence is with us for all things political from time to time. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up. Tomorrow we will talk about what the president's going to say tomorrow night.